online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, can a cider really rival a wine? Nick Showering certainly thinks so. A former apprentice contestant from a Somerset cider family. He'll tell us about his triple vintage edition that's made its way onto some Michelin-starred menus. Cider is synonymous with rosy, scrumpy, and let's be honest, a banging teenage hangover. But as we reported a year or so ago, there's actually been a huge shift in its perception, thanks to the efforts of a handful of determined producers who've been determined to make sure it's recognised for its parallels with fine wine. We hear a lot about the success of English wine, most especially sparkling, but this country's artisanal cider sector is also getting more and more attention. Nick Showering is from a family cider business, steeped in cider, in fact. Some of his first memories are of picking apples at harvest in the orchards. He might also be familiar from last year's run of The Apprentice 2, where he reached the 8th episode, I think, if my research is correct. We'll talk about that later on. But he's fired up by something else, his latest creation, a triple vintage cider, which is delicious. And he joins us now. Welcome to The Drinking Hour, Nick.
Hi, David. Well, thank you very much for having me on.
You're very welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. We don't talk about cider very often on this podcast. We have done it once before, episode 10. I found it really fascinating. And I suppose we should start. I know you will flinch at this sort of what I mentioned, the kind of the stereotypes of cider. But I think we should take that head on because you are really out to prove a point here on cider being something that can be associated with fine drinking, aren't you?
100%. I mean, you've got it in a nutshell there, really. I'm obviously extremely passionate about cider because my family's been making the stuff for 180 years. So it sort of runs through the veins. And I've always felt that cider hasn't quite had the recognition it deserves. Because in a sense, wine and cider are very similar. They're both fermented fruits. The only difference being that one's from grapes and one's from apples. There's arguments to say that cider could reach the highs that wine do. It's just that those expertise and the specialisms that are applied to those fine wine houses has never been done to cider. So I'm sort of on a journey to unlock that potential and open people's perceptions and open their eyes to the fact that actually we've got this amazing product that is home in the UK, beautiful apples that we can make incredible drinks with.
I mentioned the success of English wine, most especially sparkling. And there's a lot of pride in what has been a quite remarkable growth story in the last decade or so. But actually, in heritage terms, presumably, cider wins on the heritage score, doesn't it?
Well, 100%. I mean, there's a very interesting history around cider and wine drinking in the UK. Now, I'm not a historian, so don't quote me on everything I say, but I believe cider, many hundred years ago, cider was one of the biggest drinks in the UK. And then what happened is the trade channels between the continent and the UK started to open up. And at that point, wine then started to take over because we had this new drink that was coming from the continent to the UK and became very popular. Cider then took a slight backstop. But like you said, with the British fine wines and the movements that's happening there, it's just a very exciting time for English drinks. And it's fantastic that wines are able to do it. And I just think cider is one of those that has perhaps been left behind a little bit and neglected because they do make ciders in France, but the conditions that we have here in the UK, the soil, the temperature, the gentle sloping hills, it's perfect for cider making. growing of the right apples. And not only that, we have the specialisms, we have the skills here that have been passed down through generations with the growing all the way through to the producing of the ciders. So I think everything is in place with the UK to champion this very British product. It's just a case of raising that awareness and raising the perception. But I think it's not just a case of raising perception as such and just telling people, okay, actually the cider you're drinking in the pub is as good as your wines. It's about putting the effort in from seed almost to bottle and trying to compete with what wines are doing with the amount of effort and resource that is put into the producing of the drink. And that's what we're really done at Showerings is we started this project in 2017 because we thought that the way to make the best possible cider is to blend three vintages where you get a lovely complexion of the three from the slightly more aged vintages, which bring a depth and character, and blending with a more recent vintage, which brings a youthful, light, fresh finish. And what you then get is this unbelievable combination of flavors. And I think it's that effort that goes into the aging, sitting on 6 or 7 years worth of vintages, and then blending them together that hasn't really been done before. So not only are we trying to raise the awareness and perception, we've actually sort of got we're doing the right things in order to make a fantastic product.
It is unusual. I was looking through the IWSC cider results from last year. Most ciders, even those that do very well, are vintage. So is it a bit like champagne? You can even out some of the inconsistencies of vintage and bring a kind of harmonious consistency by mixing vintages.
What you find, every vintage and cider is going to be different based on the conditions of the year. So 2022, for example, we had very little rain and a lot of hot weather, which meant the apples were tiny but full of sweetness. You could actually go to the orchards and take a bite out of one of the cider apples, one of the Dabernets, and it was edible. Whereas normally you take a bite and it'd be completely sour and unedible. So that's going to have an impact. So each vintage does vary. But what we find with the blending of three is that when you age, the flavors really round out and you get a depth to the cider. We didn't want to just go with, we didn't think that one vintage, an aged vintage from, let's say, a 2018 alone would be the best we could possibly do, because it almost becomes too heavy. But what we thought was the best way we could possibly make a cider was to bring those notes into and blend with the more recent vintage, which gives this, I mean, like I said, just this absolutely fantastic sort of flavor thing going on in your mouth when you try it. You have the gentle acidity coming from the apples. You have an aged profile and then a really nice, light, youthful finish.
So it's more about depth and complexity using those back vintages than it is about consistency, which would be the case generally in non-vintage for a sparkling wine, for example. This is about achieving something richer and deeper, is it?
It is with the older vintages, but if you were to try the Showerings, you would actually realise that it does have that youthful, light finish, which comes from the recent year.
I have
which is fascinating.
It's got a lot of freshness as well.
Yeah, and we didn't want to make a really heavy, a flavor-heavy cider. If we'd have wanted to do that, we would just we'd do it by vintage, so it'd be 2017 or 2018 vintage. But where we thought the real genius would be with this cider would be to combine the old aged with the new, and you get this amazing thing that happens where you do get notes of the old and aged, but you also get a nice freshness, which is something completely new with cider. But I think it's worked fantastically for us.
Yes, tasting it, I was really struck by the parallels with the way that we assess a wine when we judge a wine. So acidity, obviously fundamental, I would say it's the spine of the wine, and I think it's the spine of the cider too. And then you've got complexity, depth, and to a degree, it's different, but you've got tannins there as well, haven't you?
The tannins always bring that sort of acidity through. And Showerings is to be enjoyed like a wine, because what I really feel passionate about is the fact that red and white wines have dominated the fine dining table forever, really. You know, you make some nice food or you go out for dinner and you think, I'm going to have a glass of something with this. It's going to be a red or white wine. But what I find so exciting is the fact that if there's a cider that's good enough, why not try a cider with it? with your food. You know, pair it with a lamb, a Somerset lamb curry or a roasted pork dish, and you open up a whole new level of flavor combinations that you just can't do with red or white wine. And that, to me, is fantastic. And some of the top chefs in the country have kind of got on board with that, with showerings, and have put it on their tasting menus and things, and they love the idea of that. But however, saying that, we are still a cider. So we don't want to become too similar to wines, because we want to offer something a little bit exciting and different, an alternative food pair. So there are those tannins there, but we stick true to the originality of cider, the original flavors of cider. So those tannins and acidity, they're always going to come through. It's a distinct note in any cider, and we're staying true to that because ultimately we are a cider. And especially, you know, in the same way that you get regions of wineries will have a very distinct taste, Somerset cider, we have stayed very true to our speciality, how we know to make cider, and the region, which does carry slightly more tannins and that slightly more, how would I describe it? A little bit more of a, on the east side of England, they use dessert apples, which are even probably more lighter. So, you know, they're even sweeter. We are, Somerset is very traditional in that sense, where it's proper cider.
Proper cider, meaning it's the apples are...
The apples used.
Apples.
Exactly, yeah. So right. the apples used are cider apples. So principally we use the Dabernet. And cider apples carry far more tannins. And that's why cider, in the same way as wine, you get regional flavors. The people in those regions, the cider makers, have always made cider in that certain way, in addition to using certain apples.
I was going to ask that, the kind of terroir factor, because of course you'll be aware that, you know, Burgundy probably being the best example, you know, in wine, there are significant differences in what is actually geographically quite a small area, and you get these quite significant differences that connoisseurs can immediately identify. Is the same thing true with cider?
Certainly, definitely, yes. I think there's not as many options, because wine, as I said at the beginning, wine has gone on this incredible journey, where it's had the investment from houses and demand from the general consumer, that it's been able to get even more specialized in regions. Cider, I don't think, has quite got to that level yet. But there are distinctions. So if you were to try a cider from the east coast of England compared to a Somerset cider, totally different. Totally different.
And what about the methods of production? Is it also, I assume it must be, true in the way that it is with wine, that, you know, the vessel that you choose to use has an impact on the finished wine and therefore the finished cider?
Yeah, that's definitely true. We don't oak age, because when you try the showerings, a lot of woodiness comes through naturally from the apples and the orchard trees themselves. So if we were to oak age, it would be too much wood, essentially. I'm not saying you'd have a mouthful of wood, but we think those notes would pull through too far. So we age in aluminium, and we just think that's the best way for letting it mature and not get too contaminated with any other notes. But our process is, as this cider is of the highest quality and made in any way, the best way you possibly can, really. All fresh fruit. I mean, our orchards are 7 miles away from the mill, so they haven't got far to go. They're picked at perfect ripeness, brought to the mill, pressed at the mill, fermented, allowed to ferment naturally. So we don't sort of, you know, ferment up to a higher ABV and then reduce it down. We allow that year's vintage to ferment completely naturally. It arrives at its ABV. And only at the point of blending. So we'll have all the vintages at different strengths. We then blend them, and that's how we arrive at our finished ABV. And that's an interesting point, that each batch of showerings will actually be slightly different, in because every batch has got different vintages in it and a different proportion of vintages. The batch will always be listed on the label, so you'll always know what vintages have gone into it. But what I'm sort of hoping is that people buy into showerings as a maker, you know, the same way that you maybe one vintage from a wine house might not be to your taste, but you know that next year it will be. So every batch will vary slightly, depend on the blend amount and also which vintages go into it.
Are you very involved in the making of the cider yourself?
I would say, in truth, I am more involved in the blending, the final blending. So there's our head cider maker is a man called Bob Cork, who's been with the family for 50 years. And he judges on all sorts of international cider competitions. He's very well respected within the industry. He looks after the fermentations and the slightly more technical aspects of things, making sure the vintages are aging correctly, ensuring the pressing's happening correctly in the mill season. But when it comes to blending, we sit down as a family with Bob, all the six vintages lined up, and we then agree a final blend. And at that point is when I predominantly get involved and decide on the final taste of the batch.
And how do you do that? What are you looking for?
Interesting. I mean, it's a very, very long process because there's sometimes a bit of arguing within the family about how it should taste. And there's quite a few rounds. So we all sit down. Everyone's got different opinions, really, because you've got Bob, the head cider maker, who he is the definition of a cider connoisseur. And I think if he had his way, Sharon's would be so niche in taste profile that you'd probably only get about 500 people in the country who'd like it, because he would, you know, he likes cider his way and that's how he thinks all ciders should be. But it's just, for me, it's too far one way. It's too extreme. You can't make a product that only 500 people, proper cider enthusiasts, are going to enjoy. So it's a group decision, but ultimately this showering, it's stayed true to cider, and it's particularly Somerset cider, while carrying notes of the older vintages with a lovely fresh finish, which is designed to be paired with food. And that's where we've got to with it.
It's very well balanced. It occurred to me, you know, I was talking about those parallels with assessing wine, in terms of the, you know, the acidity, the fruit quality, the maturation, if that's relevant, you know, tannins, length, etc., depth, complexity. But balance is really fundamental here. You're dealing with acidity and fruit, aren't you?
100%. And the balance of showerings is absolutely essential. And that's really, I think, where the aging comes into play. The aging rounds it out, gets rid of any sort of sharpness. You do keep that gentle acidity, but I think that's important.
You also have a kind of bit of etiquette to the way it should be consumed. I used a wine glass, a burgundy glass, to taste. Do you prefer this to be served that kind of way?
We definitely encourage it. So our suggested serve is always in a stemmed, oversized wine glass. You know, we suggest serve chilled, so that's why it's in a stemmed, to not overheat the glass when you're drinking it. And I do, if available, an oversized wine glass, just because you don't want the nose to get overly concentrated by a smaller rim to the glass. So you want to let it aerate and let those notes out a little bit, and with a gentle swirl. You don't want to too aggressively swirl it to keep some of those notes in there.
I naturally swirled it, but I wasn't sure if that's what I was supposed to be doing. So that's very interesting. It's you don't want to do it too much, because presumably you lose too much, do you?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So you don't want to overswirl, just enough to release the notes. And it's fascinating, actually. If you have the first and second notes, the difference is unbelievable. So you try, you have a smell when it's in the glass without swirling, and then try it again second time. It's, you know, the difference is unbelievable. So you're not warming the glass up without ice, because look, if someone loves a cold drink, they can put ice in it, but it's not the suggested. You want to be able to understand and get into the flavors, so you know, ice just sort of removes that, and a nice gentle swirl, and then you're good to go.
And you also suggest, I think, a pouring method that will be familiar to anyone who's been to northern Spain, to Bilbao or to San Sebastian, where they pour from quite a height. What does that do?
Well, we would say not from a high height, from a medium height. Not quite, because I've seen what they do in Spain. And I don't think even I could do that. That's very specialist. The skill, I think they can do it from behind their back as well.
Oh, they can. And God knows how they do it, because it would go everywhere if I tried to do it. But
I know, honestly. You have to have two bottles, just one for practice and then one for actually going for it. It's poured from a medium height just to allow a little bit more breathing to come into it and to knock out a little bit of the carbonation for when it hits the glass. So you don't want it coming straight out of the bottle and keeping all of that fizz intensely in there. So you want to knock out a little bit of the bubbles and it'll breathe slightly as you pour it.
And you've had gastronomic opportunities that a top-end cider presents. You've talked a bit about some potential pairings there. You've had some significant success already with some Michelin-starred dining establishments in this country, haven't you?
We're at the very beginning of our journey, and Showerings isn't available in many places, many restaurants. We're in a handful in London, but I was very fortunate to have Alain Roux from the Waterside Inn in Bray, which is where his three-star Michelin restaurant is. He was a big fan of the cider, actually, and he's put it on his tasting menu there. He's paired it with the cheeses, which is a very classic cider pairing. And, you know, he's very kind and has a lot of nice things to say about the cider, which is absolutely fantastic. And look, there's only a handful of three Michelin-star restaurants in the country, so we will be on menu in slightly more than just a three Michelin star restaurant, but that is the optimum, really. Someone who's in that setting, who can enjoy the cider with food of that quality, is exactly how I envisaged it. But it's not closed to that. As long as someone's passionate about food, and there's good food being served, Showerings can be there as that alternative pair.
And is it always going to be sold by the bottle? You wouldn't put this in a in a pub through a tap?
We won't ever be on draft, no, because we're aging 6 and soon to be 7 years worth of vintages. We just don't have the space really to store that much to satisfy big demand like that. We can only really do small batches of the cider because of that limitation, and we've chosen to make less of it but store more and have it of a higher quality. So we wouldn't ever be able to be rattling out pints of the stuff. But we wanted to make the best cider in the world. And we would prefer to be making less of it, but it was better.
Yes. Well, small batch is the way to go if you're going for an upmarket product anyway, I would say. So that makes a lot of sense. Tell me a bit about your... I mentioned in the introduction, you're sort of steeped in cider, which sounds delicious, actually, being steeped in cider. But tell me a bit about that upbringing and the family and the cider links in Somerset.
Well, about 180 years ago, my family had a pub in a Somerset town called Shepton Mallet. And ever since then, they've been in the drinks industry in some form or another. It went from one pub in the town to a collection of pubs to brewing beer in the pubs, cider, and then delivering the cider locally. And ever since then, we've been in and around the drinks industry through the generations. And cider has always been at the heart of that. It's Shepton Mallet and Somerset is, some people might disagree, but I like to think of it as the home of cider. And we've been in the heart of Somerset. We've made Perry's over the years. But those pears, we never had pear trees, so those pears have come from, I think, Hereford. But in some form or another, we've been making cider for a very long time, and that's just also backed up and assisted by this our head cider maker Bob Cork, who's been with the family for so long, for over 50 years, which is just amazing. So he's an old sage when it comes to any cider questions. I mean, his knowledge on cider is probably beat ChatGPT or Google. He's probably got more information than Google does on cider, but he's amazing. And we just thought in 2017 we reinvested in our cider mill and developed one of the best cider mills in the country. And we thought if we've got one of the best mills from a technical aspect, we should have the best cider. And so I'm on this mission to open people's eyes to cider and hopefully bring something that they agree is one of the best drinks out there.
I want to talk about Perry as well, but we'll come to that in a second, because you mentioned the apple variety earlier, Dabinets, which I confess I hadn't heard of before, probably because it's not an eating apple that I'd be familiar with. Just tell me a bit about the apples that you choose and that variety specifically.
Our grower is a man called Bob Wadey. So the two most important people involved are both called Bob, which is
confusing.
Can be a bit confusing. And he has been doing it. He's been doing it for 30 years or so. His orchards have won all awards, I think, there are to win. And actually, we don't enter the orchards anymore into awards, because I don't think there's much point. Because once you've won them, the orchards don't change too much. But he is the expert. But we do have the Dabinet is a very common cider apple. Especially in Somerset, it's one of the best cider apples to use. There are some which aren't indigenous to the UK, which came over, I think, as a plant species. Actually, I would be guessing if I told you when that would. But actually, I mean, we use Harry Masters, we use Browns. There's about 8 varieties that go into it, but it's principally the late season Dabinet.
And it's the same as the way we talk about grape varieties, presumably, you know, the different apples bring different qualities to the mix, basically.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. So you'll get different levels of sweetness, acidity. And it's that blend of apples, which I think is part of the skill of cider making, where you pick and choose how many of each you're going to blend into a vintage. That is really the beginning. Well, you've got to grow the apples, but once you've grown them and picked them, the beginning of the milling process is really deciding on the blend of apples that are going to go into the cider.
You mentioned you're on a mission with cider. Are you on a similar mission with Perry?
No. We had this ambition to make the best cider in the world with Shirings, and I'm very much focusing on that. There's one product. We're not doing different variants or anything like that. This is what I think is the best we can do, and this is what we're doing. However, we have made Perry's in the past as a family, and I do think Perry is another thing that has got potential to be unlocked, because as a fruit, pear is actually more delicate than grapes by nature. And in my opinion, a Perry has the potential to reach far higher qualities than a champagne ever could. I just think the reason why champagnes go to such unbelievable heights and just can be absolutely delicious is the fact that the way they're made. You know, you look at France, and you've got the process that goes into making a bottle of some of the finest champagnes is just unbelievable. And nothing like that has ever been done with Perry, not even close. But I think that potential is very interesting. And I'm not saying with Shirings we've gone to the level of some of the champagne houses, but it's a step towards that. And I would, yes, certainly at some stage love to try and do something incredible with Perry.
Why I was interested, because I tasted a series of Perry's for episode 10. So this is 2 years ago, but I hadn't really tasted Perry beyond, you know, Baby Sham when I was about 15 and drinking illegally. So, and I was blown away by the potential for Perry in place of something like champagne, actually, with that delicate character you mentioned, which is why I wondered if it was something that was an ambition of yours. But it sounds like you're going to do one thing first before you focus on the next.
Yeah, I think at the moment, just sticking with apple, because I just think that's, you know, cider. We've got that single ambition to make the best cider in the world, and I don't want to confuse that, and I want to just really focus on that and not get myself distracted, and keep bringing out each batch of Shirings to be the best it possibly can be. But I am fascinated with the idea of trying to produce a Perry that can compete with some of those other sparkling wines, and I think it's possible. It's just the process that goes into making some of those fine sparkling wines is unbelievable. And I think Perry and any Perry manufacturer is a very long way off that. But it interests me 100% to see the potential that Perry could go to. Because it was actually Dom Perignon actually stole the idea from cider makers. So there's a bit of history for you there. It was, he saw what was going on in the UK with cider, thought he'd go to France and do it with grapes. So yeah, cider did it first.
There you go. You were an originator. Well, or cider was anyway then. Talking of, you know, of being focused and getting, you know, not trying to take on too much, that sort of brings us neatly to why you, I presume, still get recognised in the street from time to time. And that was because you were, you did actually pretty well on The Apprentice last year. I think it was up to episode 8, if I have done my homework correctly. I think you you fell victim to a corporate shindig at Silverstone, as I recall. But why did you do something? You're clearly a, you know, serious minded, you know, entrepreneur or wannabe entrepreneur, from a, you know, family steeped in a particular business. Why did you want to do something like The Apprentice?
Yeah, good question. For me, it was double, maybe triple pronged, actually, three reasons. So when I first applied, it was lockdown, and I was just scrolling the internet, and I had an advert pop up, say 3 days left to apply. And I just thought, you know what? I always fancy myself on that show, and I always thought I'd be quite good. So I saw it, and I just put an application and thought nothing of it. And the process starts rolling, and you do stage after stage, and eventually I got offered it. So I sort of fell into it in that sense. I'd always quite wanted to go on it. Second point would be for the experience. I was fascinated with the idea of doing something like that, because it's not every day you get an opportunity to throw yourself into such a steep learning curve and an experience and do something that, you know, you've got 8 cameras on you, being grilled by Lord Sugar, you've got your other candidates grilling you. But on top of that, you get to do some fantastic things. You get to start a new business every week. And that's just something to me that sounded like the best summer ever. So the experience as well. And then third, it was the idea of being, I didn't actually have a business at the time, but obviously you get the investment if you win. And I wanted to go for it. I wanted that investment to catapult me into doing something, a business of my own that I could do. You know, I've now found my feet since the show, and I'm doing that. But that was probably my third reason.
Do you regret doing it, or are you pleased you did it?
touch wood so far. I'm glad I've done it. You know, you get warned about a lot of trolling and online stuff like that. But I met some lovely people on the show, some friends for life. You know, you always get a few messages and comments of people giving their opinion, which might not be preferable. Mm. But I would say overall, people warm to me. And I just had a really good time. I had a lot of fun with it. That Silverstone episode, I ended up getting fired for not cooking the corporate lunch quick enough. I missed my deadlines a bit. But, you know, that's why I go into cider. I got 6 years to age this stuff. No rush at all. But I loved it. I had a great time. And, you know, unfortunately, I didn't win, but still learned an incredible amount. Probably mostly about myself, funnily enough, because you get put in these high-pressure situations that you just can't imagine. You know, watching the show, you just can't imagine the situations they could put you in. And you learn a lot about yourself and how you handle those situations.
I worked for a while with Kate Walsh, who came second in one of the early series of The Apprentice. And the point she always used to make, that people don't really think about necessarily when they're watching, is that you're all knackered. Because the pace is incredible, and you do see all these 4 a.m. starts where some poor sod has to answer the phone, and then they all go schlepping off in a people carrier. But did you find fatigue to be an issue when you were doing it?
Now, I would say that the kind of the duty of care that they do is very high. So it's a well-oiled machine, and they do look after you, and you're never under too much stress. And if you are, you've got plenty of people to speak to and stuff like that. However, there are some very early mornings. I think the craziest one, I did fishing in Cornwall, and we got to bed at, we finished eating at about 9 p.m. and then got to bed by 11, and we had to be up at 1:30. It was absolutely nuts for a full day out on this fishing boat catching fish in Cornwall. That was intense. And there's some incredibly late nights, because it's not just what you see on the TV. You know, there's all the post stuff, the interviews, and they capture an incredible amount of footage to then condense to an hour. So you do get tired. But I think it's, you know, it's a business show, but at the end of the day, it is television. And I think a little bit of sleep deprivation makes it a bit more exciting. So I didn't mind that at all.
Yeah, well, it's... you know, it is intelligent TV as well. So it's not a million miles from doing something serious with Cider, which, of course, is why you're here now. What is your aspiration? You know, when you're in business, you tend to try to think of a horizon, you know, what that looks like and what you'd really love to do, to achieve. What's your ambition for Bosch Cider?
So the passion for me comes from being able to share this experience of your enjoying your food with a different pair. Red and white wine, don't get me wrong, love them and they're fantastic. But this showerings with food is fantastic. And I just want to share that with people and open people up to taking that risk and trying a showerings with their food, because it's delicious. It opens up so many more combinations. And the real aspiration for me is that I want cider drinkers to enjoy it as well, but you're not going to be in the pub enjoying the showerings. It is going to be for the fine dining, but it's the wine drinker. I want the wine drinker to experiment and broaden their horizons and at least take that risk for one glass. I mean, you know, it's one evening, it's one glass. Take that chance, try a showerings. And pair it with something delicious.
I mean, I tasted it, very much enjoyed it, as I said, awakened to those, you know, wine parallels in terms of tasting. I confess, I had it on its own, and I would have enjoyed it enormously with something like Roquefort cheese and nuts, probably, as well. But you mentioned pork, which is an obvious one because we tend to think of applesauce. But, you know, that I can imagine that working very well because of the acidity cutting through some of the fatty content as well with something like pork belly. What would be your kind of optimal pairing if you had one chance to sort of sit someone down with a bottle of it and say, you know, I'm going to cook you. Maybe you shouldn't be cooking them a meal because you were late with the food service at Silverstone. But you know,
yeah, definitely not.
But if you were going to offer a food to go with it, a combination, what would be your kind of desert island combination?
I think for me, it would be a heavier dish. So I think that's why I talk about the Somerset lamb curry, because it's the one thing that I've tried, which works fantastically with it. Something heavy. People might naturally think a fish or pan-fried scallops or something a bit lighter. And ultimately, it's personal preference. But I think because Sharon's is aged, it works very well with some of those classic red wine pairings. And so anything... Yeah, I think if I had to choose, it'd be a Somerset lamb curry.
Okay, well, there we go. So Somerset lamb curry all round then. It's a great pleasure to chat to you. I wish you the greatest luck. I think you're doing a great thing by setting out with a product to champion that one thing. I think that's incredibly focused. So best of luck with showerings, triple vintage cider, and come back and tell us how it's going in a while, or when you launch your first sparkling perry perhaps. But Nick, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on. It's been a lot of fun chatting.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
So we always round off with some medal winners from the IWSC, and they are normally either spirits or wine. Lest you didn't know, cider is also judged every year in addition to wines and spirits. And this summer, the IWSC is bringing its international judges to Somerset to judge cider, perry and fruit wine made from 100% juice, not from concentrate, in collaboration with Cider is Wine. There's still time to enter, by the way, if you make one of these products. The closing date is June the 7th. Let's feature some medal-winning ciders from last year, the reigning champions, if you like. Eden Speciality Ciders Heirloom Blend Ice Cider 2018. This won a gold medal, high score, 97, 98 points. And the judging panel, some familiar names here who also assess wine or spirits. So Ivan Dixon, Christine Parkinson, Timothy Fowlson and Alistair Morell. And this is what they said in giving their gold. Magnificently pronounced and focused. Here we have layers of zesty citrus, acacia honey and sweet vanilla sitting alongside fresher, fruitier tones. The palate is intense, silky and fabulously concentrated, and the finish amazingly lengthy and complex. Superb harmony throughout, they said. Another gold medal winner. This one from the UK, Tinston Wines and Ciders, Gateway Cider 2019. Fabulously sophisticated and elegant, said the judging panel. Here we have wonderful layered aromas of fresh yeast and green apple with sweet vanilla notes. The nose gives way to a complex autolytic palate, revealing delightful champagne-like flavours of fresh pastry, butter and biscuit. Heavenly, said the judges as they gave that a gold medal. There was gold too for this one from Poland, Sidir Chilicki, Graf number 2, non-vintage. The panel said a gorgeously scrumptious and well-crafted cider with delightful notes of sweet flowers, freshly baked brioche, zesty orange peel, bruised red apple and delectable nuts, possesses a pleasantly dry finish that lingers blissfully. Wonderful, they said. And finally, a fourth gold medal winner from last year. This one's from Germany. Muxala Cider Probstier Dien, non-vintage. Also a gold medal winner, as I say. The tasting note, rich and impressively complex. A superbly broad aromatic profile invites us in, full of fresh apple, barley sugar, marmalade and cinnamon. Seductively mouth-filling on the palate with excellent depth. And an attractive, savoury character lingering on the finish. Exceptional, they said. That's it for this edition of The Drinking Hour. My thanks to Nick Showering for a fun chat. Thank you to you two for listening. You can find my monthly wine column at clubanalogique.com. There's more detail on the cider judging that I mentioned that's coming up in Somerset in a month or so at iwsc.net. And you can follow Food FM on Instagram or Twitter. I'm also there on Instagram and Twitter as Mr. Venusaurus, if you want to seek me out. In the meantime, thanks for listening and do join us next time. For now, goodbye.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.